almost as terrifying as imagining the Maker showing up unannounced. He said, I've got enough agents in Ardeen to track him down without... And what if he popped up on Earth instead of here? If we finally managed to get someone through, who's to say the Maker, with all his additional resources, didn't manage the same? And maybe with better fidelity. His abilities outstripped ours by an order of magnitude before we killed him. We need the Kray on this one. Jason rubbed his face. Several things could have triggered Carter's return, including Jason's constant probing for a connection with Biter. Hell, the USB stick Jason had made for Banks with all its recursion programming might have done it. For all he knew, maybe even something the Kray had done precipitated Carter's reappearance. Jason said, no. No more Kray. I can't afford to. They could give you an entropic seed, like last time. The betrayer blew out his breath. If I give those alien bastards another inch, who's to say they won't grab a mile, or everything? If Jason opened the fences of Ardeen as he'd done when he'd first betrayed the Maker, the entire land of the curse could be erased, including Jason and all his clones. Gamma said, if we get what we need from them and act quickly, it won't matter. We'll take back everything the Kray steal and more. Jason frowned. Who's we? Gamma snorted, a figure of speech. I'm sure. Don't forget who's actual. Gamma wisely held his tongue, because he knew better than Jason himself that Jason had already decided to ask those fucking Kray for another favor. If the Lord of Mageddon was going to survive, he needed to break the rules again. Damn the consequences. He needed to be war again, whatever else. That was the only way to be safe. The only way Jason could imagine not being afraid. Jason descended from the tower, leaving Gamma behind. He made his way to the xenobiology foundry. A few reds puttering about the dissection tables where a breed of burrowing crawler was stretched, skin flayed, and its disintegration organ revealed. Upon seeing Jason, the reds set down their dissection scalpels and bowed. At least Delta's retirement was still fresh in some of himself's heads. "Where's Sigma?" he asked. "Off shift," a red mumbled. "Back in a few hours. If you want, I can run a message to him." Jason considered, then, "No. In fact, get lost. I want some privacy." The red scrambled to obey. Once Jason was alone, he returned to the cryotanks. Time to unthaw an ambassador from the Strange. Well, no, not an ambassador. The Strange was chaos and strife unending, separating domains unimaginable to humans. The Kray were cockroaches in the walls of the cosmos compared to all myriad strangers cruising the dark energy network. But out there, even cockroaches had access to computational wizardry that would dwarf anything in the so very finite domain of Ardeen. The Seven Rules gave Ardeen protection. But with that protection came limitations. It was an age-old compromise. A dark bulk lurked behind the cryotank's frosted glass. A Kray captured after its metamorphic birth inside Ardeen was a difficult achievement, unless you didn't care how many clones were lost in the process. Though it took time to grow new homunculi, it had been worth the investment of flesh. Jason wished he'd asked one of the reds to remain behind to open the valve on the largest cryotank. The wheel stung his hands with frost. Oh well, he'd heal. And he wouldn't have to slay the red afterward for witnessing the emasculating event that would occur immediately afterwards. Asking the Kray for help yet again meant trading away more of his autonomy. But to ensure his success, Jason couldn't see any other way. More than anything else, he wanted a stable connection back to his home, to Earth. Carter created Ardeen to protect Earth from their bumbling intrusions into the Strange. Somehow, Carter's death unsynchronized the chronology between Earth and Ardeen, trapping Jason and everyone else in Ardeen even more completely. Until Banks and Paldridge made a fumbling step towards actual quantum computing, enough that Jason had been to complete the contact with Biter. Unfortunately, the link was unstable. Making it permanent was his primary goal, and he only had a little time before the chance was lost. Gamma was right. Jason needed the help only the Kray could provide, even though their aid was insanely dangerous to accept. But if he didn't risk it now, he might lose all his future chances. The raw computational power available to the Kray and other entities of the Strange wasn't normally a threat to Ardeen or Earth. The seven rules of Ardeen fenced out any tampering, no matter how prodigious. But Jason was within Ardeen's fence, and as someone on the inside, he could let the barriers down, so to speak, enough to accept gifts from those on the outside. In this case, he hoped, another entropic seed of the sort that the Kray broodmother incubated. An entropic seed was a computational spike. A singularity of calculation that approached infinity. Really, it was a magic wish. He'd used one before, when he'd betrayed Carter to his death during the Age of Myth. Using a seed was dangerous, because it splintered the protection of the seven rules, and broken rules were slow to mend in the aftermath. But Jason needed one to salvage the situation slipping away from him. With it, he could permanently link Earth and Ardeen. The power of the seed should allow him to accomplish at least that much, even if he had to project himself to Earth directly. With a firm connection, he wouldn't have to race deadlines. He could collect the other rings at his leisure. He could take his time unlocking the Maker's ancient bastion, the Maker's Hall. Once in the Maker's Hall, he'd fully revitalize the rings of incarnation, starting with his own. He'd be war again. Nothing would ever be able to threaten him again. It was the dream that started him scheming in earnest, but now it was almost academic, because of course he'd also be master of the hall, equal to the Maker in all ways. All Ardeen would be his to command. It would be glorious. He could go home, return to Earth as he chose. He couldn't wait to meet some real people again. It'd been so long since he'd labored in this fantasy realm of caricatures, of make-believe beings. He imagined the sun on his face, a glass of cold IPA in one hand and a cigar burning in the other, surrounded by friends. New friends, anyway. All his old ones had turned against him or were missing. Maybe he could introduce someone new to the idea of root beer floats like he and Carter used to enjoy. He chided himself on entertaining, even for one second, such a sad, pedestrian, and melancholy goal. He had far grander visions of the future. Nothing would be beyond him, really, as the new Maker. If he wanted to, he could seed a recursion of his own into Strange, one of his own design, not fucking Carter. Maybe a world where demons didn't live beneath the crust, or a world where you could soar through the sky as easily as thinking about it. A new realm. Nothing was too amazing to imagine. Though even that paled before an even grander possibility. A fresh idea. Should he manage to claim the Maker's Hall for his own? Tickled him. Why not indeed? Why should he not try his hand at extending his influence into Earth itself? Out there, in the world of normal matter, he might be able to leverage the computational power of the Strange to amazing ends. Maybe that's all the Planet of Ores wanted to do. Escape captivity and transform new worlds. Either way, better him than them. What's the worst that could happen? Jason double-checked that his belt was set to protect his mind, Before dread of what lay inside overcame him, he grabbed the locking wheel and turned. Ice lanced his fingers. He only tightened his grip and spun the wheel harder until the door creaked open. Icy fog spilled out, revealing the carapace of the Kray interpreter. Dead eyes stared at him with abyssal hunger. Chapter 11. Aspiration. Elendine, Queen of Hazurium.
Elendine, Navarre said, Hazurium isn't this way.
Elendine owed her first protector more than royal inscrutability, so she didn't shrug. She reined to a stop in the shade of a date palm. Behind her, the captain, newly promoted after the death of his predecessor, called a halt to the 20-odd members of the Queen's detail. Elendine shifted in her saddle to face Navarre on her charger and said,
I know that.
Then where? We're not returning to Hazurium. The Kephalem's ears pointed askew from each other in surprise. She said,
And why is that, my queen? I know I don't have to tell you.
Elendine said, That's right, you don't. So stop. Navarre rumbled in frustration.
But your sister's internment.
Doesn't matter anymore, Elendine said. See this? She pointed to the ring snugly fitted to the index finger of her right hand, glowing red like the sunset. The Ring of Peace, said Navarre, her voice uncharacteristically soft. You're still wearing it. It's awake, said Elendine. The first protector gazed at the queen for several heartbeats. Then she said, Your Majesty, you've lost me. How could Elendine describe it? If she concentrated on the relic, burning letters scrolled across her vision describing wonders she'd thought permanently relegated to a mythical age when the Maker fashioned the world during the Age of Myth. Elendine said, Functions my mother told me were lost may have returned. The Maker could be stirring. Amazing as that is, it's not what excites me. I care only that the ring is working again. See, I plan on using it to bring Flora back, Navarre gasped.
Back? She's set to be interred into the path of the dead. She's in Hazurium.
Navarre, Elendine said, we're going to the moon door. Once every 33 days, the moon called Glitter passed between Flare's unblinking light and Ardine. When that happened, the moon's shadow was cast across the land beneath. At one spot in particular, Flare's light was blocked completely so that night kissed the land by day. When that happened, the moon door opened.
But what? How? You can't,
said the first protector.
I can, Elendine said.
Navarre got hold of herself and started again. Even if peace has remembered ancient functions, the moon door lies across a termination zone. She raised a hand to object, but Navarre plowed on, saying, What you're really suggesting is stepping through the moon door into the night vault.
Exactly, Elendine savored the word.
If umber wolves don't get you, the court of sleep will. Navarre pleaded, her voice soft. I hold a ring whose true name is Death.
Elder Kephalem of the court will bow to its authority, Elendine said, as they once did to she who wore it during the Age of Myth.
Navarre said, But you're not an incarnation. You're a woman with a magic artifact. Before she could stop herself, Elendine shouted, I'll drag Flora's spirit from the night tunnels, even if I have to kill every member of the Court of Sleep to do it. The first protector's ears laid back and her eyes narrowed, but she kept any responses to herself. Say one thing for the first protector. She knew enough not to push Elendine too much. Though it was already too late. Anger had stripped away Elendine's earlier exultation, leaving behind smoldering coals. Elendine wanted to hit something. Why did she let Navarre bait her?
The queen spurred her horse into a canter towards the black silhouettes that tumbled over the horizon. They approached the Serpent Hills. It wasn't necessary to convince Navarre who was right or get approval. She only had to prepare the first protector for what was to come. That she'd accomplished. Let Navarre stew in her wake. The clopping of hooves on stone meant Navarre's charger followed close. The calls of the queen to tail as they saw her sudden departure floated up from farther behind. She understood that from the first protector's point of view, Elendine's actions were erratic. Her temper only exacerbated that impression. If she wasn't careful, Navarre would think that Brandolin's affliction had come to Elendine too, without the excuse of elderly dementia. If the queen hadn't cut the conversation short, the first protector might have brought up another of her favorite ways to chide Elendine. Another duty Elendine had failed to discharge. As queen, Elendine must either bear an heir or name one. Each time she sauntered off into danger's teeth, Navarre broached the topic directly or indirectly. If Elendine failed to return to Hazurium, the council would name a regent, and the line of queens of Hazurium would fail. To prevent that, the Shading Council would likely name that wench Shari Marana, Elendine's cousin in Mandariel, as the new queen. Elendine spurred her steed to a gallop. Flora would be the heir or no one. She just had to raise her younger sister from the dead. Many hours later, and some hard riding up a series of switchbacks, saw the mounted company to the top of Lobahan Pass. The pass was one of the few easy routes up the southern arm of the Serpent Hills. Full night had nearly descended, and they set camp. Elendine's sleep was troubled with images of her dying sister, and dawn's creeping orange fingers came too soon. She rubbed the tired aches from her eyes, glad to be rid of dreams of Flora. Elendine dressed and left her tent. Her detail immediately began striking it. The queen's gaze fell into the plunging valley north of their campsite, down to a twisted albino jungle. The sun's morning light limed the steep valley and white vegetation with shades of burning ember. The valley was a termination zone, where the seven rules sometimes bent and flowed like hot wax, making it a place only the foolish ventured. At the center of the uncertainty was the moon door. Elendine had never been. Her mother, however, had told her daughter the story of exploring the place so many times that it almost seemed as if Elendine had been the one to explore it herself. "Now what?" said Navarre, coming up behind. "Now," Elendine said, "we chart a path through the zone, steering clear of anything dangerous. Then let's avoid the place entirely. Everything down there is dangerous." Elendine laughed. Now that she was here and no one could deny her, her humor had returned. "Fair point, Protector, but that's our path. If we don't reach the center of the zone by noon, we'll miss our chance for another month. I don't mean to make Flora wander the night vault for even another day." Navarre's ears nervously flicked, but she made no response. They descended on a path steeper and more torturous than the one they'd ascended, leading their horses instead of riding. Brandolin hadn't described that aspect of the trip. When they reached the valley floor, morning was well along and Elendine was anxious, as well as soaking with sweat. "We've taken too long," she groused. Pale and tortured trees clogged the valley, twisted by a lifetime growing under fluctuating rules. They were also tall and strewn with creepers and hanging vines, which meant the central plateau she'd spied from higher up wasn't visible while they were beneath the canopy. Ignoring the protests of Navarre and her new captain, Elendine took the lead. She plunged into the undergrowth, swinging her sword Renswandir to help cut a path. Over the sounds of her exertion, the humid air vibrated with the peculiar calls, some high and lilting, others deep and rumbling. Beasts of the termination zone jungle, she supposed, who would hopefully keep their distance. Though she allowed herself to be spelled by the others in her detail when she grew tired, it seemed to Ellen Dean that their pace was no better than a wandering child's. When they finally broke into the clearing around the plateau, it was with only an hour to spare before totality. Carved stairs and gaping windows wound up the plateau. The interior was supposedly a wrath hunt. When the spirit of a dead creature fails to find its way to the night vault, its fate is to become a bodiless being of rage and loss, a spirit of wrath, a wrath's touch, rotted flesh, and drained life. Ribs, femurs, even a few skulls lay about the base of the plateau, probably the remains of wrath victims who hadn't known to stay away, or who had been lured by stories of treasure to be found in the night vault. According to Brandolin, the stairs were at least as dangerous a route to the top as the tunnels and galleries that mazed the plateau's interior, because sometimes demons from the deepest places walked them. Meeting a demon on the stair was worse than meeting a wrath in the dark, Ellen Dean's mother liked to say. Navar pointed to the granite doors, halfway around the circumference of the plateau, leading into the interior. The first protector knew Brandolin's stories as well as the queen. Ellen Dean shook her head. No, we don't have time to creep through the unmapped interior. That would take days. If I'm going to make it to the moon door on top of the plateau before noon, we have to try the stairs. A babble of concern drowned out whatever objections lay on the first protector's lips. Several soldiers from her detail pointed into the sky. Glancing up, the queen saw a billowing gray cloud blowing in the wind. Ellen Dean asked Navar, "What is it? Bad weather? Unless it's a breach," finished Ellen Dean. "In places where the seven rules were weak, Cray sometimes blew into Ardeen, dispersed by the wind, using long strands of webbing like kites to carry them far inward from the borderlands, or from a leaking termination zone." "But there's so many. Hundreds," barked Navar. "It can't be Cray." In the queen's experience, no more than half a dozen Cray had ever made it into Ardeen at a time, and the destruction of even so few was an arduous task. On the other hand, she'd never traveled so far into a termination zone before either. "It's Cray," Ellen Dean said, knowing it with dry-mouthed certainty. She grabbed the hilt of Rinswander and squeezed the unyielding leather-wrapped metal. What was falling from the sky was nothing less than a catastrophe. Somewhere, a gaping hole had been torn in the protection granted by the Seven Rules. Chapter 12 Confrontation. Catherine Manners. "Well, that's insane," Kate told Carter. She'd finished calibrating the fake security card halfway through Carter's account, right around when the story veered into Lunaticville. Carter shrugged. "I know. If you want off the bus, give me the USB stick and hand over the card spoofer, too, please. I'll take it from here. You can wash your hands of the whole thing." She considered his offer. No one would fault her for leaving, not even herself. Finding Jason had been weird, but Carter's explanation was all kinds of fucked up. But she said, "What happened next after you, printed back?" Carter stuck his hands in his pockets. "I dropped the code base of my defunct video game down the entangled link into the primordial network." Kate shook her head. He'd mentioned the game before, but she still wasn't clear on its significance. "Why the hell do that?" The starting grid code wasn't encrypted. It was like a big welcome sign pointing at Earth. "Planet of Ores, welcome. All you can eat." "I hoped the finished code and its rules would fence out anything not part of the encoded setting. Ardeen, land of the curse." "Did it work, I mean?" He nodded slowly. "The next thing I remember is waking up in a self-storage unit 3 years later, wondering about my kidneys. Earth's still here, so it must have." Her finding a melting man in a server room was almost pedestrian compared with the enormity of Carter's story. Kate's brain staggered and skipped, trying to grasp it. So, someone built that crazy network? Were these planetivores Rome? He shrugged. I'm making lots of assumptions, but yeah, based on what I saw looking at the raw code in the starting grid, but a long time ago. My guess is that the network was created as a transport system. Kate tried to imagine a transport system built on dark energy, but failed. She wanted to ask something more incisive, but all she could come up with was, really? Maybe. I don't know for sure. But I've been thinking about it. And if it was a transport system, it explains the printing protocols already in place between the real world and the network layer. I didn't just whip that code up out of the whole cloth. She nodded, as if he'd made sense. Carter pulled his hands from his pockets, mimed grabbing something with two hands and breaking it in half. My best guess is that this wonderful, amazing alien transit system broke. Lots of travelers were stuck inside, over aeons. Terrible things evolved from what was trapped in the network. Desperate to escape, they eventually figured out a way to get out. A terrible way, which is why I came across planetivores. Or maybe planetivores went wrong in the first place, he shrugged. Either way, based on what I glimpsed in the code, it looks like those things eat civilizations in the real universe of normal matter every time they find one. Why? Why do these things want to eat worlds? Kate flashed back to reading Jonah and the Whale as a 10-year-old. In her mind's eye, the whale, already old and bloated, grew with the ages. Over deep time, grew large enough to swallow the entire Earth. She shuddered. I don't know, said Carter. Maybe they're just badass aliens who survived being pulled into the network by earlier waves of planetivores. They could be emergent intelligences of the network itself, or something I can't even imagine. Probably all those things and more. The dark energy network is immense. Talking to Carter wasn't solving anything, nor were his answers proving to be easy to hear. In fact, the more she heard, the less reassured she felt. So she slapped the flash drive ring from Jason into the hand of the man with the mad story. Then she swiped the spoofed card through the reader. When the security door clicked, she pushed it open and asked Carter, "You coming? I haven't got all day." Carter nodded, obviously surprised. "Thank you." He made as if to go first, then motioned her ahead instead. A good sign, Kate thought. He'd remembered which one of them was trained at breaking and entering. 10 minutes of sneaking saw them outside the door of a corner office. The frosted glass bore the title, Liza Banks, CEO. A yellow-orange glow filtered through the glass, as well as the sounds of more than one voice. They put their ears to the door. After a few moments, Carter whispered, "Can you make anything out?" She shook her head. A lot of mumbling was audible as of at least two people talking, but nothing sensible. A male voice seemed excited, and another actually did seem a little bit familiar. The door was yanked open. "Don't move," someone yelled. Kate squinted against the unexpected light. The voice belonged to a man with greasy hair holding a gun on her. Fuck, she raised her hands. The CEO's office was richly appointed. A gargantuan flat-screened monitor dominated one wood-paneled wall, displaying gray-white curls of static. An equally gargantuan desk crouched beneath the flat screen on carpet that probably cost more than Kate's annual income. Someone was tied into the desk chair with a bag over his or her head, so Kate couldn't see who it was. That wasn't too creepy. In addition to the gunman and the captive, the office also contained a pudgy man with a neckbeard. Finally, An impeccably put-together woman with horn-rimmed glasses stood near the gunman. The woman gave a fake, perfunctory smile. She said, "Hello. Took you long enough to get from the garage to my office. Well, come in, but slowly. Don't try anything stupid. Fred has a twitchy trigger finger." "You knew we were coming?" Carter said. Kate gave him a sidelong glance. "Duh." Fred the gunman gestured with the snub nose of his pistol and backed away far enough to give her and Carter room to enter. She complied, her mind very much on her own concealed weapon as she shuffled forward, but it wasn't the time for sudden movements. Carter followed her. They stopped where Fred indicated along the office's back wall. Kate said in a tight voice, "Liza Banks?" "The one and only," the woman said. "And you must be the precious detective. And there's the fellow we heard over the garage intercom spinning tall tales. Carter, is it?"
"You heard me?" said Carter. "I didn't see a mic.
Maybe that makes things easier." Liza shrugged. "We were wary already, on account of the other visitor who arrived before you. BDR is a popular destination today. If I'd known, I'd have put out appetizers." As she spoke, Liza walked over to the captive sitting at the desk beneath the flat-screen TV. She pulled off the captive's mask.
"Raoul!"
Kate yelled. Raoul's sheepish expression was hampered by a few fresh contusions. He said,
"Hello, mi chula. Who's your new friend?"
His eyes flicked to Carter. As she'd feared, Raoul hadn't bought her dog-walking excuse. She cursed herself. She should have said nothing. It would have been less suspicious. But she hadn't expected that Raoul would make a beeline for BDR while she dallied listening to Carter's story. Liza said,
"You know him."
"Makes sense. Though your coordination is terrible. We caught him trying to jimmy the doors to the executive lobby. We were just getting down to brass tacks, as Fred says, when we heard you on the intercom." Carter said,
"Then you know the danger the Dark Energy Network represents. If you don't..."
Liza raised her hand, saying, "Whoa, cowboy, slow down. I've heard enough to concern me about your mental health, yes. And that you have something that belongs to me. Hand it over." Neckbeard looked at Liza. He said, "Hold on, what if there's actually some kind of danger? My last set of tests returned results I frankly can't explain." He gestured to the static on the flat screen as if that was some kind of proof and continued, "Whoever this Jason is, he isn't providing us with the full story."
"That's why he sent the flash drive," said Liza with an exaggerated expression.
"He said that'll contain all we need to make the qubit chip and quantum computing a reality."
"You can't trust Jason," Carter intruded. Fred raised the gun. "You shut up."
Carter glared, but shut up. Kate finally got over the shock of seeing Raoul. She said, "What's your interest in quantum computing? Are you trying to corner the market on VR like Carter was?" Gumman didn't tell her to shut up. Maybe because he didn't feel as threatened by a woman. A mistake a lot of men made. Liza said,
"Virtual reality, please. Dr. Paldridge here," she gestured to Neckbeard, "promised me that his quantum computer would have an absurd amount of processing power, applicable to a wide range of schemes, but only if someone could iron out the difficulties. Someone like himself. With Jason's help. That kind of power could blow through any encryption in seconds."
Kate blinked. A pure money grab, then. She wondered if the woman had ever thought her scheme would come down to hiring gunmen and putting sacks over people's heads. To Kate, Liza Banks seemed nervous beneath her boasting exterior. Probably best not to test her, though. Besides, she just remembered a story that had been at the top of the security forums for weeks. Kate shifted her attention to Neckbeard and said, "Mr. Paldridge, is it?" Neckbeard said, "Dr. Paldridge, but yes." she continued. Don't we already have quantum computers?
Carter shot Kate a surprised look. She ignored him. Paldridge bit his lip and said, No.
Some Canadian company has been selling quantum processors for a while now, Kate said. I'm sure I just read about it online. D-Wave?
Liza snorted. Paldridge gave an emphatic shake of his head and said, Those D-Wave machines are quantum annealers, not quantum computers. They're not even comparable to ENIAC. They can only solve a small subset of problems, not generalized quantum algorithms. I aim to bridge that gap.
All right, then. The man seemed to know what he was talking about. Let's see.
Enough chit-chat, Liza said. Hand over the device. Get it from them, Fred.
Fred advanced, pressing the gun to Carter's side. Kate instantly understood how Fred had sacrificed the distance advantage a firearm provided. On the other hand, Carter was obviously cowed by the brazen threat. Carter said, It's in my coat.
That's what I'm reaching for. Is that all right?
Fred nodded. Carter's hand inched into the pocket of his pea coat, then emerged just as slowly with something balled in his fist. Kate considered going for her own gun while everyone's eyes were on Carter. But Carter beat her to the stupid. He twisted suddenly, knocking Fred's gun hand with his elbow, trying to grab Fred's arm. A gunshot tore through the office, louder than a car crash. Carter gasped, collapsing. The ring dropped from his hand and bounced across the floor.
You shot him, Kate yelled. Her ears were ringing and her own words came out muted.
Liza's mouth hung open a moment in similar shock. She whispered,
Oh, that wasn't supposed to happen.
What did you expect, Fred said. He had it coming.
Liza swallowed. In a tight voice, she said, Paldridge, bring me that.
She pointed to the ring Carter had dropped. Fred, see to the man you just shot. If he croaks, I'm shooting you next, damn it.
Kate said again, louder, You fucking shot him.
Fred growled at Kate. Try anything, bitch, and I'll shoot him again. Then he bent to the fallen Carter.
Let me help you, Kate begged. I promise I won't cross you.
I won't cross you yet, she silently added.
I just want to make sure my friend doesn't bleed out.
Fred looked at the bleeding man and seemed suddenly out of his depth. A second later, he motioned her over. She crouched next to the stretched-out Carter. A red stain was blooming on his upper chest beneath his shirt. Kate hoped it was upper enough that the bullet missed anything too vital. Paldridge had gone pale and shaky, but he retrieved the ring as Liza requested and examined it in his cupped palm. The big costume jewel caught the light. He pulled the removable section from the ring and said, What an odd flash drive. Kate didn't have time to explain the extraordinary circumstances by which she'd come by the ring. She was too busy applying pressure to a bullet wound. She yelled at Fred, Get a first aid kit! Fred gave her a disinterested stare, but eventually said, There's one in the closet, he pointed. Get it yourself. As Kate tried to explain how that'd require her to let up pressure on the wound, an electronic squeal howled from the wall-mounted display. Another whine like tires spinning on asphalt followed it. The static cleared, but not quite completely, revealing a man. He wore some kind of bulky black suit. Was it iron armor? Interference made everything jaggy. When the man spoke, his voice sounded as if it echoed up from a well. Kate couldn't understand him. Banks went to the desk and fiddled with the keyboard of her computer. She said to the image, Jason, you're breaking up. Please repeat.
Jason?
Kate studied the monitor. The interference made it hard to tell, but the man did have brown eyes.
But she'd seen him melt.
The figure said, You've created the bridge. Congratulations, but it's a shaky connection, and I need you to finish the process I outlined to you. Why haven't you done it already?
The CEO walked into view of the blinking camera over the monitor. She said,
Someone stole the flash drive. This woman, she pointed to Kate, and her friend. But we've got it back. Dr. Paldridge is going over it now. Paldridge started. He said in a hesitant voice, yes, everything looks to be in order. Preliminarily, of course. I'll have to download and read through the specs. I imagine we'll want some modifications based on what I find. Jason wasn't looking at Paldridge. His eyes, fixed suddenly on Carter's bleeding form, grew wider every second. He suddenly screamed over Paldridge's ramble. I knew it! Fucking Carter Strange! Back in the flesh! He got shot, Liza offered, obviously unhappy at the admission. Really? Said Jason. I doubt that'll keep him down for long. Or another one just like him if this one croaks off. Thank the Maker I prepared for this contingency. Banks, put on the ring, quick. What? Why? She said, confused, and perhaps a bit of caution in her voice. What would that accomplish? She glanced down at Carter, eyes narrowing. Kate imagined the woman was reviewing what she'd heard of Carter's story. But she held out her hand to Dr. Paldridge, who relinquished the ring to her waiting palm. Liza held it up before her, gazing through the circle of the band. Put it on, Jason repeated. It's not as elegant as I'd planned, but that's why I talked to the Cray. Liza said, Cray? The supercomputer company? You promised no dealing behind my back, Mr. Cole. Jason cocked his head, then chuckled. No, never mind. You're still my first choice for business partner, Ms. Banks. I need you to put on the ring because in order to unlock the flash drive, the ring needs a biometric signature. He grinned unconvincingly, Kate thought. If Kate had been the one holding the ring, she would have thrown it. Fine, said Liza, but she didn't put on the ring. Instead, she hastened to where Raoul was quietly taking in events from the comfort of his restraints. Hey, Raoul protested, leaning away as far as he could as Liza brandished the ring at him. Stay back if you're proposing. I don't accept. Liza spun Raoul's chair around. After a bit of finger wrestling with the cuffed man, she forced the ring over the first knuckle of one of his fingers. Raoul stiffened as if the ring was electrified. Kate launched herself to her feet, but the cold steel barrel of a gun in her side checked her mad dash. What's happening to him? Kate yelled at the monitor. That ring is very special. Here in Ardeen, it was once one of seven. Now it's merely a bridge, a way to make connections. That's what desire promises, after all. He laughed. So I'm using it to come across to see you, said Jason. Then static washed away the image. Raoul convulsed. He screamed. His head snapped back and his eyes lit with pale blue fire. Everyone in the room flinched back. Raoul slowly relaxed. He lowered his regard until he fixed Liza Banks with a burning gaze lit with evolving fractal sparks. He said in Jason's voice, It's a cliche, but true. If you want something done, you've got to do it yourself.
Chapter 13 Possession Jason Cole. The pudgy computer scientist and Liza Banks inched away from Jason, almost trampling Carter, who blinked stupidly on the carpet. A circle of blood swelled by slow inches beneath him. And it was Carter. Jason could scarcely believe it. He'd been Jason's bogeyman for decades. Now look at him. Shot and dying. And Jason hadn't lifted a finger to put him there. It was bittersweet. How much he missed what they'd once been, and how much he'd come to hate and fear him later. Now he was about to expire. Carter was obviously far less dangerous than the gunman who couldn't decide if he should be pointing his weapon at Jason or at a red-haired woman wearing a coal-black business suit. The woman is Kate Manners, whispered a voice in his head. Then, who are you? What's going on with... Jason viciously suppressed the voice. The vessel knew things Jason didn't, but allowing it any autonomy would risk compromising his own control. It wasn't like he really knew what he was doing. The most recent aid he'd begged from the Kray allowed him to make this crossing, but that didn't mean he understood how it worked. Thanks to the Kray ambassadors in Tropic Seed, he was installed in a human mind. But he didn't know for how long and just what his abilities were, if any. Liza Banks should have been the vessel, but she hadn't put the ring from Ardeen on her own finger, damn her, and now his hands were tied, literally. "Banks," he said, directing his gaze at BDR's CEO, "untie me before Carter gets back on his feet." Banks stared at him as if he'd sprouted a second head, which wasn't far from the truth, he supposed. "Roll," said the woman his vessel had named as Kate Manners. Jason ignored her. His initiative was crumbling. He had to get out of the bindings. Roll surged with renewed fervor to throw Jason out. Jason had expected the vessel to remain stunned and uncomprehending while Jason rowed him, but Roll wasn't having it. Keeping control of the body, and more importantly the mind, was like trying to stand still in a hurricane. "Focus," Jason told himself. He visualized Raoul as a tiny point of light and his own control as an evening darkness. The light pulsed and flitted, but Jason finally caught it. It just required concentration. Then he flooded the vessel's bloodstream with adrenaline. The man's muscle fibers contracted with more than normal strength. Ligaments and fibers screamed, but the restraints, actually only a sweater someone had found to tie Raoul down, tore with a snarl. Jason stood, tossing aside the shredded polyester. He said, "Now then, as I was saying." The gunman turned tail and banged out through the office door, his footfalls receding in the corridor. "That makes things easier," Jason said, with a grin stretching the corners of his mouth. I would have been pissed if my triumphant return was interrupted by a mook with a 45. No one knew Jason's limitations, and if he played his cards right, they never would. Liza grabbed Dr. Paldridge's shoulder, but her eyes never left Jason. She said, "Do something!" Said Paldridge. Jason cracked his knuckles. "You can't put me back in a bottle, Ms. Banks. But don't worry. I'm not staying long, nor am I welching on our deal. I still owe you the secret to true quantum calculation. The time congruence between Ardeen and Earth will slip if we don't fashion a stronger anchor. If that happens, you get nothing." "Time congruence?" repeated Banks. She looked at Paldridge. The pudgy man opened and closed his mouth like a carp out of water. "Never mind," Jason removed the ring and gave it a once-over. It was like desire, yet unlike. It was no longer a ring here on Earth, but it had made the transition and survived it, unlike his own clone. Jason twisted the translucent jewel to reveal the USB plug. "Hold it! Don't move, Raoul," came the voice his vessel instinctively responded to. Kate Manners. Jason glanced up. Sure enough, Kate had brought a gun of her own to the party. "I'm not Raoul," he said. "Jason, then," Kate replied. "I tried to help you before when you were sick in the server room, and you repay me by... She shrugged, but the gun barrel remained trained on him. "Hijacking, my friend?" "Whoever you helped, it wasn't me," Jason said. "It was just an instance, disposable. An instance. Like a computer program running in multiple partitions simultaneously," Jason said. "Or you can think of the version of me you met before as a clone," Jason sang out to the tune of "I Think We're Alone Now." "I think I'm a clone now. There's always more of me running around." No one laughed. He blinked. Why had he done that? He was supposed to be scaring these people, not serenading them. "Okay," said Kate. "So you're a clone too, right?" "No, I'm the original. My mind's entangled and translated here, not duplicated. The clone you met was Zeta, one of my lieutenants. Just between you and me, Zeta was always a bit too wishy-washy. Clones sometimes amplify my own most disagreeable traits. Happens like that sometimes. Raoul's inner voice said, "Chatty fellow, aren't you?" He was oddly talkative, Jason thought. What had gotten into him? He rubbed his eyes. Maybe he was just hungry, or Raoul was. Either way, he decided the very next thing on his plate would be to order pizza. Pizza! His mouth watered at the thought of melting cheese, crisp garlic crust, and juicy slices of pepperoni, right after. "I helped your, clone." "When it needed a hand," said Kate, interrupting his train of thought. "Help me now. Let go of my friend Raoul." Jason regarded Kate. Despite the gun she held on him, he liked talking to her. It was exhilarating. He hadn't really talked to another human being other than themselves for, he couldn't remember the last time. The Kray certainly didn't count. Being cut off from Earth and living as a shadow of a broken incarnation in Ardeen for 200 and some years had a way of changing a man. Maybe his aims had become too skewed, too fixed on revenge. Maybe... The vessel's mind leaped for control and knocked Jason aside.
"Kate, shoot me, in the leg! Shock this hijo de perra out of my head!"
Jason reasserted control, forcing Raoul back into silence, though not completely so. Raoul was proving far more adept at resisting possession than should have been possible. Was Jason's erratic behavior, singing about clones for fuck's sake, due to Raoul's struggles? If so, then it wasn't going to stop until Jason vacated. That gave him an idea. Jason put up his hands and said,
"No! Hold on, don't shoot me. I'm back in control. Jason's gone."
How much he sounded like Raoul, Jason wasn't sure. He heard the man's Mexican accent when he'd briefly reasserted control and tried to duplicate it. An accent like that would be easy to overdo. But he only had to fool the woman for a few seconds. Kate lowered her gun a fraction.
"Raoul?" "Yes," Jason agreed. "And I know what to do."
He leaned forward and slammed the USB stick into Liza Banks' laptop.
"Hey!"
yelped Kate and Dr. Paldridge almost simultaneously. Kate continued,
"You said that thing was crawling with malware. How do you know Banks's computer is isolated from the web?"
"I'm counting on the opposite," Jason replied. Glee stretched a circus clown grin across his stolen face. Kate's gun snapped into position.
"Take it out," she ordered. "Now."
Jason laughed. "Auto-run code activated the moment I inserted the drive. It's too late. Shoot me if you want. Kill your friend in the process. I don't care. I'll just skip town, so to speak. Meanwhile, the information I want to release is already self-propagating." Liza Banks said,
"Wait, what? That wasn't the deal. Only Paldridge and my people at the Institute were supposed to get that."
"You and your friends have everything you need, Liza," said Jason, "which is a head start. You'll get there first, probably. Stable qubit chip production is something I can't rely on just one outlet for. If your Institute friends fumble it, I'm screwed. So you have, at most, a few months before the worm I uploaded becomes active. After it's spent 90 days or so propagating all over the net. After that, who knows how many people will be able to make quantum computers according to this particular specification. I only need one to succeed. And bridge the gap into the strange," he didn't say. Once a translation gate connected Earth and Ardeen, he could bootstrap that into a matter gate. A gate that would allow him to return to Earth in the full glory and majesty of an incarnation. Or maybe even as the Maker, if all his plans came.
"Jason,"
a voice whispered, this one not in his head.
It was Carter. The man was sitting up, looking at him.
Don't do it. I don't know what's happened to you, but do you really want to destroy your home? Do you really want to end the human race?
Jason felt a moment of guilt, but anger washed that away.
Carter, I just want to say fuck you. You've had this coming for a couple of 100 years, my time. From the perspective of war, whose ring you gave me, you've actually had it coming for thousands of years. So let me assure you, revenge is sweet.
Carter said, his voice weak.
You know what's out there? In the Dark Energy Network? Why are you doing this? Because I want to be war again. You don't know what it's like. I want to be war without a master, the Maker, to call me to heal. But the Dark Energy. Call the network what we decided on. It's the Strange, just like what people in Ardeen started calling you, Carter Strange, the Maker.
Carter only looked confused.
Could it be? Did the dying man before him have no memory of becoming the Maker? Fuck. Jason wasn't really getting his revenge. At least not directly.
The disappointment was so palpable, he almost felt slapped.
Was this just a copy of Carter? One who hadn't fucked him over by trapping him in Ardeen?
That's when Raoul's mind struck again, stronger than ever. Jason's control slipped.
"Ardeen isn't the only world seated in the Strange," whispered Raoul's silent voice. "Other recursions exist. One is older than even humans. It's where I'm from. Ardeen isn't alone in the Dark Energy Network. And we won't let you destroy what we've spent so long cultivating."
With that came a mental jolt filled with images of an alien world, the like of which Jason had never imagined.
"I don't understand," said Jason, or tried to.
Instead, he lost his grip on Raoul's struggling psyche. Entangled particles yanked him away, back down into the primeval network. Chapter 14. Immigration. Carter Morrison.
"Jesus, I'm shot," I said for the second or possibly 12th time.
The horrifying sensation of hot blood pouring down my back from the exit wound was worse than the excruciating burning below my collarbone.
I was absolutely going to die. I knew it like Stephen King knows what lurks under the bed.
Kate yelled at the pudgy scientist, pointing with her gun barrel.
"You help Carter. Put pressure on his wound."
Paldridge took a couple of hesitant steps towards me. Banks announced,
"I'm calling the police."
Kate's aim shifted a few millimeters, putting the CEO in her sights.
"Don't.
Or we'll have two gunshot wounds to deal with," Kate said. Banks swallowed, eyes fixed on Kate's unwavering pistol, and stayed where she was, wringing her hands and scowling. How'd this woman get caught up in Jason's crazy scheme? Kate shifted her attention to the guy Jason had puppeted.
"Raoul?"
Grayness around the edges of my thoughts made it hard to think. Paldridge distracted me from hearing what Kate told him because he'd started tearing strips from his lab coat and tying them around my wound.
"You're going to be all right," he said. "I don't know what all right means to you, but this isn't it," I said.
Even to my own ears, my voice was tremulous. Kate led Raoul over to where I was slumped. He was surprisingly unfazed by everything and even assisted Paldridge in completing my field dressing. Kate kept her eye on Banks. When they finished wrapping me, I felt weaker than ever. But at least the jacket slowed the bleeding. On the other hand, blood was already soaking the bandages. The creeping redness coincided with a cold feeling in my stomach, inching larger every minute, turning me into ice. "I'm going to pass out," I said, deciding at the last second to keep the conviction of my imminent death to myself. "So we need to figure out some stuff before that." Kate's brow furrowed. "And we need a drink."